first things that happened to me personally when I went to Denver from here, and you may not know my history, I was on staff here as sort of the staff evangelist from 1970 to 76. My primary responsibility was the Saturday night Maranatha concerts, which had, you know, three or four different personalities. My shift was 70 to 76. I was 26 years old when I felt strongly led to move to Denver and plant our church, and we've been there ever since. And our church was, in a mid-size range, a few hundred people, and I'd been there about 3 years. And we were trying to do a little newsletter, and there was one of the Broncos who I knew to be a Christian, and I went and did an interview with him for our little newspaper. And as I sat out, you know, in front of the practice facility, we really hit it off. His name is Steve Foley. He played for about 10 years for the Broncos. He was a defensive back, played free safety. Never went to the Pro Bowl, but came close. And as we continued to talk, we just sort of hit it off. And, I mean, really hit it off. We just talked for a long time, and I realized something at that point. The ministry is pretty lonely, and so finding a friend at any given time those first few years of church planting, you're lucky or fortunate or blessed, however you want to put it. And, you know, one day we were talking, and his day off was the same day as mine, which was Tuesday, and we always go fishing or duck hunting or something like that. And we were sitting there talking, and we just kind of thought, because we hadn't known each other very long, and we kind of looked at each other, and I said, you're a professional football player, and I'm a pastor. Why have we just sort of hit it off? And we thought for a minute, I said, it's because we're only as good as our last Sunday. We're only as good as our last Sunday. Performance. Such a major issue. And we began to talk about that because for him, the coaches would, of course, look at tapes of every single move they make. Well, we don't need coaches to take us through everything we've done or said. We do that ourselves. If we don't, our wives will do it for us, as you well know. And I think that Peter John's message was a brilliant one, because I don't know that we'll ever really completely avoid assessing the performance aspects of ministry, but it causes you to constantly be grading yourself. And so the issue of, was I successful last week? Was I successful this month? Am I successful at all? I think it daily haunts pastors and ministers. And I think, as I shared in the introduction, one of the tough things is when the senior pastor is insecure about the place they're at, it can tend to be a pretty harsh judge with those that serve in the church, because we all want a tight, you know, slick, you know, want everything working. We want the tapes duplicated and the bulletins handed out. And then you look around and realize these aren't people you can fire because they're volunteers. But you get just as frustrated with them as if they were employees, except they're not employees because they're volunteers. So how much are you going to get out of a volunteer and then judge them for it? I mean, it can produce a crazy-making environment, church can, because it really is about something that is somewhat synthetic and somewhat real. I use the term synergism, though I define it a little differently than most, but I call it synthetic energy. And what that means is it's like trying to define morale, right? You know, or the momentum in the game has swung from one side to the other. What's momentum? It just means one team's doing better than the other team at any given moment. And so you have this invisible, these readings that we're always kind of checking out, and then we make a lot of judgments about ourselves and about other people in this somewhat strange and mysterious world we call church. And as I said here, I think, and I've watched people attempt to be ready for everything when they go, you know, to plant a church. And I'm not real down on studying your demographics. I think that you need to know something about your city, because if you don't ahead of time, you're going to find out sooner or later. But I don't think you can really ever prepare yourself totally to obey the call of God. You're almost always, no matter how well you've studied your demographics, it's always a step of faith. It's always a matter of obedience. And then there is this, you know, how am I doing? And, you know, if you ask the sheep how you're doing too often, then you're not the leader. You're supposed to know. And so I want to, because of the shortness of time, I want to introduce some things to get you thinking more than try to bring any conclusive points or conclusive evidence of this. But I want to start in Exodus 18 because there is a very, very important point here that I think Sandy addressed earlier today very well. It's in Exodus 18. Most of you are familiar with this text and the others that I'll refer to. Jethro, who was the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, he hears all that God had done for Moses and for Israel and his people, and he goes down and brings Moses' wife and his sons, and he observes, starting in verse 13, what Moses is doing. And so it was the next day that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood before Moses from morning until evening. So when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did for the people, he said a very gutsy thing. What is this thing that you're doing for the people? Why do you alone sit and all the people stand before you from morning until evening? And Moses said to his father-in-law, because the people come to me to inquire of God. Now Moses understood who he was and that he was a messenger of God. I mean, he settled that, before he got out of the burning bush experience. I mean, he did all of his arguments and, all of this stuff with Aaron and all of his doubts, got all that, all that worked out. I guess I'm the man. God wouldn't let him off the hook. And so he just rather matter-of-factly says, well, the people come to inquire of God and I'm God's guy. Well, that was true. And Moses said to his father-in-law, because the people come to inquire of God, and when they have a difficulty, they come to me, I judge between one and another, and I make known the statutes of God and his laws. That was his job. He was going to write the law of Moses. So he's just describing his job description. He's not in error at any point here. But Moses' father-in-law said to him, the thing that you do is not good. Now, how could what God called him to do be not good, be in that category? When all he's doing is what God said to do and giving the statutes of God, which he was perfectly set to do, qualified to do because of God's calling. And so here we introduce the idea of management, time management. This is as biblical a concept as you can get. He's doing the things that God had called him to do, but something was wrong. The thing that you do is not good. Both you and these people who are with you will surely wear yourselves out. For this thing is too much for you. You're not able to perform it by yourself. Listen now to my voice. I will give you counsel, and God will be with you. Stand before God for the people so that you may bring the difficulties to God. And you shall teach them the statutes and the laws and show them the way in which they must walk and the work they must do. Moreover, you shall select from all the people able men such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, rulers of tens. Let them judge the people at all times. Then it will be that every great matter they shall bring to you, every small matter they shall bring, that they themselves shall judge. So it will be easier for you, for they will bear the burden with you. Several concepts here. Easier for you. What's that mean? Well, anybody that's been in the ministry for 10 minutes knows that it's a workload. Lazy people should never consider the ministry. If you're a clock watcher, don't consider the ministry. You have to have a work ethic, and a strong work ethic. And so I think that Moses is obviously in a position where he's doing the job that God had called him to do. Now, there's two things I just want to point out as we kind of open this up a little bit for discussion. One is that the selection concerning these men who were to rule is reminiscent of the book of Acts and the selection of deacons, obviously. How in the world could these guys get away with saying the needs of these Hellenistic widows is not important for us to take care of? It would have been so easy for someone to spiritualize and say, how could you not? You're not a pastor. You're not an apostle. You're not going to take care of these poor, unfortunate widows. And they could have, been put on a considerable guilt trip for that. And pastors are generally vulnerable when it comes to those kind of accusations. You don't care for the sheep. Now, these guys understood their job description well enough to know that it was the right thing to do, to select Greek deacons who understood the dilemma of these poor women and to take care of them. And it was an act of strength on their part to say to take care of them would be the wrong thing to do. So you have some similarities here. I mean, Moses is agreeing that, well, this morning to night thing of judging all the people, even though it's my job description, I'm supposed to do less of it? Well, evidently. You mean, being alone and praying and studying and preparing is more important than these poor widows? They just lost their husbands, for heaven's sake. They're alone. They're hurting. How can you say I'm... A lot of different kinds of decisions are made when you consider what the right course of action is, what the right priorities to set for yourself and others in church. But one of the things that, first of all, you see here is what I call authorizations. Now, again, you're familiar with the text, but what's happening here is there are evidently authorizations. Captains of tens, captains of fifties, captains of hundreds, captains of thousands. Now, there's probably a lot of different ways to look at this, but from the viewpoint of God's authority, there are certain levels of giftedness required for certain kinds of ministry. One of the reasons why I think success, the definition of success is difficult, is we exist in a movement that has experienced success. And I know some movements where they never have to worry about who's going to be the next megachurch because there aren't any. There's a lot of denominations that are not dealing with definitions of success that have anything to do with numbers. Now, if John Corson had a church of 10 people struggling in Oregon, most of you would say this afternoon he's a success. At what? Parenting. Wouldn't you think? I'd give him pretty high grades for raising that boy. So it depends on what you're measuring and then the combination as well. So in our movement, because there are numbers are one of the ways that we measure things. And I think that works in this authorization of captain of thousands. Now, one of the reasons why I think that hating covetousness in verse 21 is so important, and if you look at it, it's very strong. Hating, despising covetousness is a very important thing in, I think, the realm that most of us live in. Obviously, God had done great things for Israel, and Moses was trying to manage the problems that the great things God does often bring about. And these authorizations were immediately instilled. Some people were given the job of being overseeing tens, some fifties, some hundreds, some thousands. Now, if those designations were, say, given out at our conference today, many of us would be tempted to, and we already do it, to look at the guys, wait a minute. How come we need 50s? I want the hundreds job. I'm sorry, Moses. Tens? Wait a minute. Covetousness stops team play. It ruins it. There can be no satisfaction in a movement unless we hate covetousness. You simply have to hate it. That thing that pops up in you that says, I want what that guy has. You know, one of the things that can be downright depressing for people is just coming on this campus and going, what? Look at them flowers down there. I don't have flowers like that in my yard. Now, you have to realize something. I grew up here, in effect. I came in the ministry here at 19 or 20, and I left when I was 26. And I thought God was going to give me gazillion-dollar givers. Never happened. God has always given Chuck stewardship over wealth and people and different. And I think the reason is because he gives. It's all a channel. But the idea, and different ones of us have sat and talked and went, man, how come God doesn't do that with us? And we just sort of kind of expect it. Well, he just hasn't chosen to do that. And after a while, you just go back home and trust God that he's going to take care of what he wants to take care of with you the way he wants it done. And I found that he does that. He provides for what he wants. But one of the things that we've had to learn over the years, even amongst ourselves, let's take the megachurch guys, and we're always up there kidding with each other and messing around. And a lot of times that can be discouraging because people look at that and go, well, those are the guys with the big churches and we're just the game, and that whole kind of thing. Stop it. Because one of the things that you look at McIntosh and Greg Laurie and myself, and some, see, years ago we had to hate covetousness, or we wouldn't be friends. You see what I mean? The competition, the idea of ambition, the idea of doing the error of comparing ourselves one to another had to go, or we would not be able to function as a team. Had to realize that when God sent Mike down to, and it's sort of funny, and this is something that a lot of people don't know, is that where Greg went, two or three different young men went there to meet that need, and it just wasn't right. I went and did the Bible studies for a few weeks in San Diego that ended up becoming the San Diego Church, but when I went, it just wasn't right. It wasn't God. And because we knew something was happening, and we learned right away that God was placing. See, God gives apostles, prophets, pastors, teachers to the church. And so in order for this job in front of Moses to get done, everybody had to hate covetousness. The person with 10 couldn't look at the 1,000 as though they had a better deal. It's different gifting. Not long ago, I took a small group of people from our church on a scuba diving trip. And I love to scuba dive. I'm a dive master. I love to teach, and I love to teach people that. I took about 20 people on this trip, and I came back almost sad because for a week I got to pastor. With thousands of people in my church, I never get to pastor. I'm always doing the CEO thing, you know, making management decisions. And I came back after that week so refreshed because I got to pastor. Bigger isn't always better. But when God places the authorization, there's a certain satisfaction, there's a certain godliness and contentment that needs to be understood. But then here's the other thing, and it has two sides of it. Remember, years and years and years ago, Don McClure said to someone, I'll never forget it, and it was someone that was coming in and seeing the upward mobility, the rapid upward mobility of the young pastors in Calvary and what God was doing around here. And there was sort of an assumption, and I'll tell you where that assumption comes from. It comes straight out of American U.S. capitalism. And it's the idea that every step is a step upward. You see, we're empowered by that. And I remember Don saying to somebody, he says, you know, being a deacon doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be an elder. Being an elder doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be an assistant pastor. Being an assistant pastor doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be a senior pastor. And when you examine your heart and mind, we're programmed for covetousness. And as a result, a certain discontent. Now, if you go to Russia or an Eastern Bloc nation, there is no upward mobility, and so no one's thinking that. No one's thinking, I'm going to climb the spiritual ladder of faithfulness to a position and a full-time job in the church, because they don't exist. So to let us off the hook a little bit, we're programmed, you know, to climb. We're programmed to climb. Well, one of the things that often happens, and I think it's going to happen in a hard way, especially with my generation, the baby boom, is when there's no more rungs on the ladder, and you have to be happy with where God has put you. Now, if you stay there, it can get depressing, because on the other side of that, there is the necessary faithfulness if God is going to advance you in the ministry. But what we forget is advancement is servanthood. See, one of the most humbling things is trying to serve several thousand people that aren't necessarily being served as well as they should. It can be very frustrating. There is a point sometimes as a senior pastor of a very large church where it's very frustrating because you're not getting it done because of the size and because of the people. Am I making any sense here? So in the authorizations thing, you know, when are you a success? Well, let me start dabbling on the board here. First of all, these are just very general terms. It can be broken up a lot of different ways, but they're kind of in some ways sociological. But it is basically physically impossible, mentally impossible to interface with any quality and know the names of 135 people. I mean, you can be the pastor to all at right about there. Some can stretch it to 150, but if you take a week or a month and you break it up, you know, time-wise, you're not going to really be able to be the pastor, the personal shepherd, to much more than that. After that, that's when the whole issue of delegation or recruit, train, deploy, and monitor comes into the picture. That's what Moses is doing. The first thing he settles is the issue of covetousness, right? Because when things start to go beyond that, and this is where churches start hitting what I consider and others consider major transitions in terms of the ability to minister to the needs of these numbers of people. Remember, the whole negotiation is based on, do you love me? Feed my sheep. Do you love me? Feed my sheep. Do you love me? Feed my sheep. I mean, they made that very, very clear to the point of frustrating Peter with that. Do you love me? Then feed my sheep. Feed my lambs. Take care of them. So the constant measurement of success in numbers is this. Are the sheep that God has given you being fed? If you were asking me, with our church of 6,000, 7,000 people, if you were asking me if all the sheep are being fed, the answer is a flat no way. We're revamping a whole lot of different training programs and servant ministry programs because we've looked at that and measured and going, man, it's not being done the way it needs to be done. There's got to be more harvesters in the field and more shepherds out in this flock. So for me right now, we've got the big church in numbers, but we're failing and have revamped, I don't want to get into a bunch of storytelling, but really have gotten a grade from God that says, you're not successful right now at feeding the sheep. So you might look at me, the large church, and go, he's a success, except God has just been telling us and convicting us over about the last 4 months that no, you're not. And when God gives you a bad grade, you don't sleep good at night. You know, and you can hide behind the, well, yes, a mega church, but when God says, no, you're not, you've got, because the job description is based on feeding the sheep, getting the statutes of God before the people, the will of God, the mind of God. So at 200, this is a major piece for people. And here's the reason. Some of it's spiritual, some of it's sociological. And what I mean by that, because I'm not going to resort to psychobabble, but I want to just say this. When you're in a borrowed situation, you're in a, Seventh-day Adventist church or a little school or something like that, there's always this sense that we're not legitimate yet. You know that? It's like my parents, I'm not going to be able to bring my parents to an Easter service because you're in a garage. You know that feeling? It's like you got this, and that's one of the cruel measurements that people put upon themselves. We're not successful yet because we don't have, my mom and dad said real churches have buildings. Real churches don't meet in, elementary school gymnasiums. And there's this kind of sense of, we're not the real thing. And yet the people who are committed to you are very committed to you, and they're not looking at you that way. But you get this reflection. And one of the tough things for people is when your attendance goes down on Easter when everybody else's goes up. That first couple of years when you don't have this perceived legitimacy, and everybody takes their parents and family to real churches. Anybody resonate with this? See, I remember those days. I remember that pain. And then you're kind of, then up here, at 250, you start going, well, all right. Well, see, right here, you're already in the top 5% nationally of size of churches. So if you start feeling some legitimacy, if you're measuring numbers, there's a reason. Almost everybody I know, they get here and they start feeling good because there's not that many churches in anybody's town of any number that are that size. I mean, talking about adults. And that's where the game gets even more and more cruel, because in reality that's a very manageable number of people. At 250 you've got 135, and a part-time assistant pastor and a secretary can take care of a church this size, and the rest with volunteers and deacons and elders. That's very manageable economically, depending on if you're renting facilities. But then you start the game gets tougher. Well, we need a building. Now there's where I don't have really any idea who I'm talking to, so I want some feedback here in a minute. But this is when you start managing this, what is success. Because again, in our system, because there is success in numbers, you have to be very careful to keep your eyes on God. Is God giving you the standing ovation You know, or are you measuring, you know, that whole piece of coming to a conference and someone asks you the inevitable question, how many are you running on Sunday, like they were a bunch of cattle or bulls in Spain, you know? How many are you running? And again, we're programmed to measure success by, you know, comparing and by numbers and by, you know, stories and programs and different kinds of things. And I think God measures success in ways different than that, but are inclusive of that. Because remember, when somebody says, well, it's not about numbers. Yes, it is. There's a Lamb's Book of Life where each person is important. So there is a point at which numbers are a part of it. But attached to the upward mobility, capitalistic climbing, competitive nature of capitalistic America, it gives you a tool to beat yourself up with and everybody else around you, and gives the enemy one too. Because there's such a satisfaction when, you know how every pastor feels after the, if Easter is really big, that's the number you want to tell everybody the rest of the year that was there. Easter Sunday attendance. See, that pull, and this is why it's ingrained into us as commercialized American capitalists. So, you know, don't beat yourself with that whip. You're programmed to think that way. In our movement, because there's effectiveness and success and such great testimonies, that furthers the program to measure yourself against the best. And some of that is healthy. Some of that's healthy. One of the things that was so evident in the earliest stages of my ministry here is the Saturday night concerts were not born to succeed. Now, some of you don't even, I mean, the tent is a matter of pictures and stories and video and ventures of faith. But I was the third tryout for that ministry. I'm not going to do the names thing, but Chuck gave that Saturday night ministry to somebody, and it didn't work for him. And what was happening in those days is that the right combination would bring 5,000 people, and the wrong combination would bring 200. You know, it was cruel. If you were good, a lot of people came, and if you were bad, nobody came the next week. I mean, it was just talk about a cruel environment. And then he had the next person try it. They were out of there within 3 weeks. You know, and then he said, "Tom, you try it. Why don't you sing a song?" I wanted to know. I don't have any part of that. You know, who wants to risk that kind of humiliation and frustration? But remember what I said about passion. I had a passion for the young people, and so that passion drives you to take the risks that put you in this vulnerable position of pass fail. And that's part of it. It is the environment of ministry, because God is interested in succeeding, but at what? And then the story was, is God blessed? And Chuck was very pragmatic about it. Another young guy came a few weeks later when the tent was being packed out and all this and said, "Well, I think it's my turn." And I went to Chuck. I said, "Chuck, is this what?" He said, "Well, let's see. There's hundreds of converts and the offerings have tripled. I think it's your job." And that's the first time I began to understand that Chuck Smith plays basketball with hoops at the end of each court. And the pragmatic side that, with an understanding of some of these principles, the lack of covetousness, the understanding of the difference between ambition and passion, and some of these things, it is very serious. But you have to measure the God factor, and you have to measure it according to the authorizations that God gives. Sometimes those authorizations are permanent. Let me tell you something about a captain of 10. There's a pastor. Someone who cares for 10 people regularly. That's a pastor. They're way more of a pastor than I'm a pastor. You see what I'm saying? Captains of 50s. Well, there you're dealing with another set of gifts. Probably a person authorized with the captain of 50s has to have more public gifts. You know, the preaching and teaching gifts, that's public ministry. There's a certain level of adaptation and skill, gifting, a natural affinity for. You can put a lot of different, you know, descriptors on that, but that you're going to have to carry a room full of people as a captain of 50s to talk to them. You're authorized in the hundreds. Now, that to me, that's a job description. That's a full-time job description. I've always had a burden for the small to mid-sized church, because those make God really happy. depending on where you are and depending on the authorization. And I think that the only thing that becomes a big church is a small church. And like children, if God desires for that church to be a driving force in the community, he's going to bring the people and bring the gifts, because when you start getting up into this, then it's a team. It's not a senior pastor, a couple of assistants, and a secretary. You're talking about a team. You just don't go out and find people that help you grow a church to 500 or 1,000. You know, you go out and try to recruit those people yourself without God giving the pastors and evangelists. You'll find out how, you know, the definition of crazy is find something that doesn't work and keep doing it. And that's where godliness and contentment is great gain. I went through something here recently with, you know, before I go into that, because that's another 5 minutes, give me some feedback. What are we building here? What are we trying to say? What are you hearing me say? I'm not that good. Somebody can read me.
Success is defined by how well you're feeding the sheep.
Yeah, that's a big one. See, every time you kind of take a jump and don't keep up with the feeding part, that's when you know you'll get a report card from God. Started small groups sooner. Remember, the small groups have had kind of a shelf life in America, and it's followed the baby boom, my generation. When in the 80s, when the baby boom was young and had a lot of young kids, baby boom was one of the least informed generations to come along in a long time. And when our kids were young, small groups swept this country. Churches and small groups, koinonia groups, small groups this, small groups that. And they weren't really based on anything other than let's get together. We're lonely, we're lost. Again, remember, this country has been settled from east to west coast, and people move all over the place, all the time, constantly. So there was a high need for relationship, I mean just relationship. It was almost as though if there was a Bible study, great. If not, let's just get together and talk. And then as the baby boom's children got older and time at home became more intense, the koinonia groups, small groups, just almost disappeared within a two-year period of time, according to Barna. And what replaced it was the curriculum-based small group. Small groups were kind of having a renaissance with a curriculum for various life skills, whether it's parenting, the Lifeway people, the experiencing God curriculum has been hugely successful in evangelical circles, because people will make time to go do something in a small group if they learn something, if it's skill specific and that kind of, and that gets into the whole subject of programming and different interests and different things. That's kind of way beyond just the basic Bible studies and whether the sports programs or they have a school and the whole. You have to be careful how you define program, because to some it's a dirty word, but I don't think so. It's just one way of cleaning sheep. Or cleaning fish. You catch them and you clean them. But to answer your question, it would have been breaking up into small groups and congregational ministries. What I mean, and I think this is what you mean by congregational ministries, they're different than small groups. They'd be like women's ministry, men's ministry, recreation ministry, young mother's ministry, things where there's a common interest, I really believe in biblical education. So in each of those, you get together to learn. It just isn't a fellowship based on your common challenge or common misery. But that's something, any way you can break down the church.
I'm doing it, but I'm not doing this part. Something's plugging up the wheel.
Yeah, remember, the key to this is other people doing it. I call it the Tom Sawyer ministry, or anointing. Get everybody else painting the fence. This is real fresh in my heart, and I'll try not to rabbit trail it, but it's something that the Lord really taught me some things, and I think has brought me personally more back to the heart of where this all began. And my daughter, who just recently got married, She wanted me, this is about 2.5, 3 years ago, wanted me to come listen to this young guy at a Baptist church, 24 years old. And I'm kind of Tuesday nights, you know, anyway, you got to hear this guy, Dad. You got to hear this guy. So I went over, and his name's Trevor Braun, and he had a kind of a youth group affair at this Baptist church, you know, about 400 or 500 Gen Xers. And I listened to him, and tremendously anointed. I mean, he's the real thing. He's got the gift. And at the time, I was teaching my midweek service on the life of David and all that Saul stuff. And the Lord kept bringing this recurrent question into my heart. And as I thought about it, he didn't have any problems. He's over at his Baptist church, and he's Baptist. I'm Calvary Chapel. You know, no one will ever cross that barrier. And I kept thinking about things, and when God's preparing to do something, you just can't get it off your mind. And I remembered Chuck was installing the toilet in the fellowship hall, and I was helping him, and Chuck signed a check to buy the Baptist Church in Riverside for Greg Laurie, $150,000. I think it was a down or something. And he writes this check, $150,000, hands it to Earl Tarrant to give to Greg Laurie. Greg was 19 years old. You know, how many of us would write a check for $150,000 to a 19-year-old that we thought was anointed? Now, there's an acid test, folks. Think about it. And I kept thinking about this, and the scenario that kept creeping into my mind is, what if this kid had some fallen out with the Baptist church and didn't have a building? Would you give him yours? I mean, I didn't even have any discussion with people. This is like going on in my spirit. And I go, that isn't going to happen. He's been there he's da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Well, the pastor had an affair, and the whole thing blew up in his face. And so I obeyed God and gave this Baptist kid my facility on Tuesday night. Remember all the carpet stories that Chuck used to say about the hippies and the carpet? We had just put in new carpet. And these Gen Xers like to baptize as a part of the service, and so they bought a hot tub. And then their nights, they put it in the middle, right in front of the pulpit, and they do their baptism in the hot tub. Well, while they were filling it, they forgot and left it on and flooded the sanctuary in the new carpet. And I was going to get my friend Smith and Wesson. And then all the carpet stories started coming to my head, and I thought, those are just stories. He didn't really mean that. He wouldn't really. And this is a big part of the story, is it's his own church. He doesn't work with me, for me. I'm on his board. And I give him some advice. He doesn't like to take my advice, but he has to because I'm always right. I mean, I've seen young men like him, and he's got this. And here, a few months ago, he went to double services on Tuesday nights and has 3,000 Gen Xers every Tuesday night. And I didn't have anything to do with it, except to give the resources. I'm supposed to go, this is my guy, he's nothing. It was just, let somebody else do it. Here's the resources. And so my relationship with this young guy, and they're just getting ready to leave. And there's and this is the part of the story that I think applies here, is at the time I saw no other Gen X type of ministry to the next generation. I saw not even a flicker anywhere, which made me sort of desperate. I mean, with Calvary, you'd think, well, where's our next generation? Which, frankly, is why the young guys are up on the platform at this conference, because we looked around at each other and went, are we going to... we look around the room and we look like a Vietnam vets conference. And then we suggested, having Peter John and Pete Nelson teach, and Chuck chimed in and says, I was at a conference not long ago, and I asked if anyone in the room was under 40, and no one raised their hand. And we realize that a big part of that is in this, is where's the people that you give absolute authorization to be a captain of 1,000 in your own church. So what was happening is God was making me do for this young man what had been done for me. And it's a little strange when you deal with your own reluctance to let go of the ministry. And I think that that's a huge piece, with this for all of us, when we see the young people, and keep that story in mind. Would you write a $150,000 check to a 19-year-old? And you say, they're so much more flaky today. Are you kidding? I knew Greg Laurie at 19 years old. And so, but what's interesting now is they've been there for 2.5 years, and he needs to take his next step. They've been trying to save money, but talk about, you know, I told him, I said, you're like a pig in a python. You've swallowed all this, and now you've got to digest it. And I won't go into the whole story, but in the meantime, along comes a whole other group. Pete Nelson, who you heard speak, and then this 22 or 3-year-old worship, you know, leader that looks like Jesus, you know, and has all the passion and this and that. And you know what? I know what to do. Nothing. Except because they're working with us and more submitted to us and of the, you know, our stream. It's kind of interesting. I had to do cold turkey. Like, here, watch God do this incredible work and have nothing to do with it. But now I know the key. The key is release. If you see a David in your midst. See, one of the problems with the baby boom is we're going to hit midlife real hard. And the difficulty with the success piece is we want to be successful. We want to be successful. We want ours. And the truth is that we're coming into a time, and I'm not speaking for everybody, I'm just speaking for my age, we're coming to a time when we should be mentoring. We should be looking, and it doesn't matter whether we have the life satisfaction that we think that Jesus should have given us in our capitalistic society. You know, and believe me, I know that. But again, we're programmed for different sources to want the numbers success. And I think that there's a whole other piece of this as you start getting into various numbers, different things you need to do at various phases. There's a certain number of professional staff you have to have at 500. Certain, you know, volunteer corps, a certain business structure, and, you know, different kinds of things. But the real issue is getting rid of the covetousness so that you can see, and see what God did for me is He just killed that thing in me that thought that building was mine. He just slew it. After a while, I started to laugh because those guys, they come in at 2, they start in the morning and take over. First of all, they cover everything that says Crossroads. And put up T&L. And look at that. And every week, you know, the blood pressure. No, no. It's for the kingdom. And they're moving the furniture. I come in one day and it's set up in the round. With all kinds of, you know. And then the next week, all of our instruments are moved around. And I'm going, but they're not. And I start to, and I just would gag on the words. The sense of elitism, you know, I'm not trying to make myself out a hero because I had weeks where I failed that test miserably. But what got done is I passed the test, and now I think I know when I see the next generation being raised up, I know what to do. Give them stuff and give them guidance and correct them when they need it. But to have a loose hand, because that's how the kingdom, especially when you're talking about size, that's how it gets done. That's how it gets done. And during that particular time, they raised up and trained 160 volunteers to do all the various ministries. And I learned something there, too. It can be done. You know, the number of captains of tens and fifties and hundreds. So what I'm trying to kind of throw out there is we live in an environment that kind of encourages the frustration in terms of how we measure success. And I think that if you can identify that demon, and because, again, if you think it's you, then you're just going to beat yourself up. But it's a lot of things. We're programmed to think that way because we're Americans. We're programmed to think that way because God's given us success. You know, he's done that. But it's up to us to approach success in a godly fashion so that we're not victimized by it along the way. And as you look at this, let's say God does have, you know, intends for you to take over your cities for Christ, which I hope He does. Then each one of these is kind of like children. And we could spend another several hours talking about, okay, if you can take care of all of them at 135, what kind of person should, you know, at say the 250 or 500 mark, there's a different way of looking at what you need next. Do you need counseling pastors, you know, to do the one-on-one, that has to be a consideration. One of the things that that I've been learning here lately is I keep wanting to have someone to be a replacement for me And the Lord has really been speaking to me about that. That's not what we need. We need more pastors. We don't need that many more. I mean, what I do is a full-time job, but you start rethinking, okay, do I need another teaching pastor? Do I need a counseling pastor? Do I need a GP? And what that means is general practitioner. One of the things that I do, because large churches tend to be a school, you know, we've got, at last count, it was 85 or 86 men and women that are out in full-time ministry, either in assistant positions or whatever, that come through the campus. And you'd lose count if you looked at Costa Mesa's. But we try to make sure that they do all the jobs. One of the mistakes that we've made as a large church is we hire specialists, because you get to a certain area and we need a children's guy, we need a this guy and a that guy. And we sometimes don't give them the opportunity, the young guys, to do all the jobs. Whether it's, you know, nursery, work there, accounting, you know, janitorial, different kinds of things. And then I'll tell you something Chuck did with us, which they used to have big board fights about this, is that he didn't pay us very much because he was paying us to move. He wasn't paying us to stay. He was paying us to be able to take either church plant or to take a low salary to start in another church plant. So if you get a guy that's a specialist and you pay him everything he asks plus all the benefits, why is he going to look to go anywhere? And you completely remove the opportunity for God to shake him up. So you'll find most of us at large church are real cheapskates. Because we want to see some people are paid to stay and some are paid to go. Bob? Well, certainly the history of this church was extremely rapid growth because there was a people movement going on. What that means is that the drug culture had sent young people, at the time they were young, to these beach communities up and down the coast of California and also on the East Coast in different pockets of the country. And so when the Lord looked down on these, you know, hordes of young people wanting love, joy, and peace, he goes, can't pass that. Wham! Pours his Holy Spirit out on him, and you have all this rapid growth. So, depending on the situation, I would say the young guy growing this Gen X church at Crossroads is real top heavy at this point. I mean, he's caught him, but now he has to clean him. It's a big target. You can throw a lot of stones at it because you've got a lot of brand new believers and immature believers and, you know, young guys looking for young girls and all that kind of stuff, and it reminds me of just the way this place was. You know, crowds have to become churches, and that takes time. I think that you see, God's in charge of growth. We all know that. He asks of the church daily who He desires, and the big thing that we want to try to do is to get out of the way of what He wants to do. So one of the things that surprised me is that God didn't need me to give any leadership to this young guy that's reaching 3,000 people in my own building. I mean, that's a very humbling experience, but I've also known that that's essential if I'm going to be able to manage the next generation, because I have to know how to get out of the way before I control. Being a large church pastor has turned me into more of a manager than I want to be. And one of the things God has done with the story that I'm telling is kind of strip me of that control freak thing that happens to large church pastors. Because the nature of charismatic leadership is that charismatic leadership goes unchallenged for the most part, unless you have real close friends. And there's nothing wrong with that. People go, oh, it should be congregational. Well, the congregation has the vote. No way. God's called the pastor to do the job. But the problem with that is that then you got to answer to God. And then when He does start working you over about a leadership flaw, he does it. So you may on one hand like to be the ultimate head of your church, but when God decides to strip something out of you, gosh, He can do it so quickly.
I guess personally sometimes you try to strategize God or say that in 5 years
four chapters before we should be. And I've noticed myself getting into a lot of trouble with that. You know, where we tend to put God in a mold that he should be working in this way, in this capacity. And just with, you know, Corson's message, young Corson, I mean, just relax and enjoy and see what God does versus, you know, it's like a marriage relationship. You know, if you're looking for your wife, you're never going to find her. It's until you let go of it and then God brings her.
Well, if you set yourself up like the typical thermometer, you know, if you're fundraising, you're just setting up a measurement that's man-made. You know, and you'll always be, you know, they always say give the sheep a board and they'll beat you with it. No, you got enough of those yourself. With this, again, false sense of measurement, you're programmed to measure numbers. You're programmed to measure success in a certain way. And some of you have heard Chuck tell this story, so forgive me if it's repetitive, but when I left to go plant in Denver after 2 years, see, I'd been the Calvary evangelist. I'd led hundreds of thousands of people to Christ, and not only in the tent, but in, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I had an ego the size of the Empire State Building. I thought, man, you know, I'd been told, you know, you've got the largest youth group in the United States, this and the other. So I decided to humble myself in church plant. And, you know, guys are already starting to plant churches around here. And Chuck said in a staff meeting, when's somebody going to have the guts to plant something outside of California? And I took that personally. That's where I'm headed, Colorado. And after 2 years, and I had done everything. You know, I had produced a lot of the Maranatha records, and I did the early sampler records. So I had a relationship with all these bands. And I called in every favor in the world. It was Maranatha Central in Colorado. And after 2 years, we had about 125 people. And to me, that was failure, man. When you've been ministering to thousands, and I was embarrassed to come to the pastors' conferences because everybody expected, well, how many you got? Because I was associated with the numbers of young people that were coming to Calvary. That was my identity. And those pastors' conferences were horrible because everyone, I mean, they would line up and ask me, you know, how's it going? How many? I bet hundreds have come. Because I went from this cauldron of blessing into an area that knew nothing of the Jesus movement. Like, Jesus what? And I called Chuck and asked for my job back. Seriously. And he says, give it another 6 months. You know, I told him what we've been doing. And give it another 6 months because you've planted the seeds and it takes a long time for those seeds to grow. And things to happen in people's lives, and between that and realizing the importance of small groups and infrastructure, I didn't have the infrastructure. I was trying to preach the church into existence by myself, because that's what I had done here. You know, all these numbers are going to hear these bands and me, I didn't understand this. And once I understood that it was different than a one-man show, you know, the singular evangelist, which had been successful for me here, that evangelizing in the context of a church plant meant recruiting other people and sharing the vision. That's something most of you know now already, but at the time for me it was a really huge void, you know, at the time to realize, oh, this is a team. This is, you know, the superstar thing isn't going to work here. And then once my expectations were dashed, you know, the idea of duplicating what I had done here, once that was gone, then God could add to the church. Because I didn't have the ruler out going, man, where's the success? Because success for me was out of thousands. Thousands.
When did you realize that?
When it didn't happen. Yeah, when it didn't happen. And after 6 months, and you know, this was a credit to Chuck's wisdom at the time. After 6 months, the church, about 400 people. People started coming. And after the sense of failure 2 years, those 400 people were so special to me. I loved that 400 people. I spent time with them. I was so glad they were there. Because up until that point, what I was communicating inadvertently is that the people that were there, the 125 were there, they were just stepping stones to something. And every time I stand up there, that I made them feel like they were insignificant stepping stones to my success. And so those 400, 500 people got treated really good for a long time because I was so grateful that they were there. And I think that a lot of how you deal with this, you know, subject of am I successful is really at the heart of your own struggle or journey. You see, when you come to these things, you're not supposed to be struggling. It's not manly to struggle. We're supposed to answer the success questions, how you doing, with a resounding, we're doing great. And I tell you what, man, we're going to start acting like Baptist schmoozers if we keep that up. I don't mean Baptists in general, but you know that whole evangelical where nobody's real. We got to be careful of that because there's that pressure. You got to remember that everybody struggled. Jacob struggled. Abraham struggled. Paul. It's the struggle. It was the humility of failure that kept made Paul great. And so I think that embracing, you know, the struggle and realizing that that's part of it. It's like, this is a big one. Couples, married couples that are raising teenagers, if you're raising teenagers, you're a failure. You judge yourself. And what you don't know is that across the board, that is the lowest level of life satisfaction for a married couple is when they're raising teenagers because they're just little monsters. And you think, you know, you're failing. You judge yourself. You don't know that it's just a phase and a stage where you get on your knees and go, oh, God, help them not die this weekend. You don't know that it's like, anybody here raising teenagers have raised teenagers? You know that? And you look at that most people get divorced during that period of time because they think it's them. And the number of men and women I talk to that think, I'm a bad person, I'm a bad parent because my teenager is messing up. And that's not the time to judge yourself, it's the time to judge the stage. They're just being teenagers. Don't judge them. Don't beat your marriage up because the kids are just doing what kids are programmed to do today. And that's kind of the point I want to leave you with that, is that to make sure, because we're programmed to measure success in the wrong way at every point. And you just kind of do away with some of the false measuring devices, which are primarily, in a sense, covetousness. I want what that person has. Yeah, one of the advantages of doing this and having a fellowship of fellowships is exchanging ideas. And I think that it's kind of like this. It works when it works and it doesn't when it doesn't. Is that you hear an idea, something that someone's doing, a way of communicating the gospel or a mailing or a whatever. And I think that you can come back... You can sometimes go back home from these things and do kind of management du jour. You know, this is what I learned. And you can make a lot of mistakes. On the other hand, though, I think every idea that resonates, because you're going to hear people that are doing different things in different ways, in different kinds of ministries. One of the difficult things for us to interpret, and I think this is why God's been teaching me some of the things that He's been teaching me lately, is because since the Columbine incident, there has been a high school revival. And I don't mean high school groups. I mean Christians on the campuses. And it's been real difficult for the churches to absorb because they don't know how to deal with evangelist pastors and teachers that are 16, have a call on their life. It's the same gifting. Now, but the thing is I'm going, I've seen this before. And strategy-wise, it's kind of like, well, the youth group can't. And so the strategy is based on what's God doing. Well, God is blessing these, you know, preschool prayer meetings. You know, the churches have nothing to do with it. The security guard calls a prayer meeting, and 600 kids show up. know, so you got to, gee, maybe we should become security guards, you know. Or in one case, well, there's, you know, you got to look, what's God doing? And then you go, well, we can't, the laws don't allow us to go on high school campuses. One of the things to remember is that in the days that, the glory days of Calvary, the laws were different. We would play high school assemblies routinely. We'd set up at lunch and play. So a lot of people don't know, too, that I found my calendar from 72, 73. And remember, we had, at any given time, a dozen or 15 groups or soloists. And I was kind of in charge of musicians' fellowship and different things. And I got this kind of going a few years ago to get some feedback. Most of those dozen to 15 groups and soloists were playing an average of 4 times a week out in the community. Well, do your math. We were college campuses, surf film openings, high school assemblies, high school lunches. Sometimes we'd play 2 high schools in a day and go, come to Saturday night, and then there's this great Bible teacher on Sunday morning. How we reach this area, because I sometimes get in trouble with this, because that's part of the real history of Calvary Chapel. Hardcore evangelism. One-on-one, where the rubber meets the road, where you were like getting bottles thrown at you, and we were out confronting the non-believing world. And so what happens now, sometimes people think, well, Chuck was just teaching the Bible. Well, he was just teaching the Bible, but during the week, there were hundreds of us out there interfacing, you know, college campuses. College campuses were the underground think tanks of the 60s and 70s. You know that. Nobody trusted the establishment, so campuses became the point of vocalization of philosophy and religion. And we played every college campus from UCLA to El Camino. We were constantly doing it. And it was kind of unseen. We just load up our trucks and go do this. We didn't realize that it was a passing privilege in our country. And as a result of that, churches all over began using music ministry. And you've heard the stories. You know, for a period of time, the concert ministry was very, very effective because the L.A. Basin was the center of music culture. You know, when I tried to do that in Denver, it didn't work because Denver's not a music town. Not really an arts town. It's a cowboy town. And so people there had to be reached more on a one-on-one. And really what began to work more in Denver was conferencing kinds of events. We'd come in with speaking events and seminar kinds of events. The music, you know, I thought the world was going to rotate on music ministry, but not in Denver. So, you know, you find out what things, if you're looking for pragmatic, you know, ideas about evangelism, you know, talk to as many people as you can. But wait on the Lord for the ones that resonate, because you can waste a lot of time and energy and money trying to work a program that's simply that. But if it's something inspired, you'll know it. Because again, remember, you guys are the shepherds in your own community, and these ideas and things that you might do here in Southern California or things they might do somewhere else are all filtered through the wisdom God has given you. And that's why you can't take a formula and transfer it anywhere. And I did learn that, I think, the hard way in the beginning. And again, the reason I'm speaking to you on this issue is my greatest enemy was the yardstick that I took from success. And I think that cost me the first, 2 years, because, again, it filtered down into everything, including how I treated my people, because it was so much about me. And then when that yardstick of success was taken away, I started to appreciate the ones that God had given me, and they were fed a whole lot better. And lo and behold, they became the things I want because I put it in the ground to die. So it's 5:00. I'm going to just hang around for as long as anybody wants to chat with me. But let me pray for you. Heavenly Father, I thank you that so many churches and so many souls are represented in this room. And I pray for each one that, Lord, you would settle some of these issues and let each one go with a sense of rest and peace about the work that you've called them to accomplish. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.
This is the end of Side 2 and the end of this message. If you'd like further information on tapes, contact Chapel Tapes at P.O. Box 8000, Costa Mesa, California, 92628. Or you can contact us by phone at 1-800-272-9673.